Do you remember those t-shirts that they used to sell at Urban Outfitters in like the early aughts that said "Getting lucky in Kentucky"? That's probably like the campaign slogan.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. On Sunday, President Trump tweeted the following, quote, "So interesting to see progressive Democrat congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, the most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world, in parentheses, even if they have a functioning government at all, end of parentheses, now loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, how our government is to be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, then come back and show us how it is done? These places need your help badly. You can't leave fast enough. I'm sure that Nancy Pelosi would be very happy to quickly work out free travel arrangements." That's the end of what he tweeted. Trump's comments appear to be referring to the so-called squad, a group of four congresswomen of color who are Rashida Tlaib, born in Detroit, Ilhan Omar, born in Somalia and a U.S. citizen, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, born in New York, and Ayanna Pressley, born in Cincinnati. But the facts of where they were born are less important than the message, which is an overtly racist one, telling people of color that they don't belong in the U.S. His comments have sparked a firestorm, at least among Democrats. And here with me to discuss those comments and more, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hi, Nate. How's it going?
It's going good. Thank you.
Also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good.
And senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And Micah is out today. Later in the show, we're also going to debate how seriously Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell should take a Democratic challenge for his seat in Kentucky in 2020. And we'll also take a look at some interesting differences in support for two ideologically pretty similar presidential candidates. Those are Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But let's begin with Trump's comments on Sunday. What is the context of what Trump wrote on Twitter? Why is he singling out these four women?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that, one of which could be that because the president has some racist bones in his body. Another answer might be that these members are pretty far to the left, and he kind of wants the public to associate Democrats with these people who are further to the left than maybe the median Democrat is in Congress. You know, I think a subtext kind of question here is like, was this on some level correctly or not a tweet the president made in an effort to be strategic somehow? You know, I think Maggie Haberman wrote a tweet that was like, the president wants to kind of recreate conditions that were present in 2016, which means a lot of racial animus and a lot of xenophobic actions and also kind of real actions toward immigrants, right? We also had this morning, for example, Trump trying to end asylum status for people who pass through Mexico from another country, meaning if you come from Central America, pass through Mexico, then he is now claiming you're no longer eligible for asylum. That will be debated, obviously, in the courts. But, you know, to me, the question is, did he wake up one morning and because he's cranky decide to tweet something that at least I found was pretty transparently racist? Or is there some method to the madness? I don't think anything particularly deep, right? But the notion that, hey, I don't pay that much of a price for this, and or maybe it actually helps me, and or I am kind of highlighting these members who I think are not very popular and portray the Democratic Party in a bad light. And I don't really have a good answer to that question.
And Perry, this is potentially commenting in some way on a bit of a feud that had been happening within the Democratic Party over immigration, right?
Not as immigration, but I mean, the last week in Washington has been dominated by news about how the squad and Nancy Pelosi have all these tensions, you know, from things AOC's chief of staff has said to things Pelosi and her allies have said. So my main takeaway, first takeaway, is that Trump follows the news really closely. We sort of know that. And my guess is this is a story in the news. He's reading about it, and his view of it is that he probably hates the squad members more than Pelosi, and he wanted to interject. And he basically defended Pelosi in the tweet series, or mentioned her and said, and sort of allied himself with her in a way that I'm sure Pelosi was not thrilled to have that kind of support. But I think that's where this came from, is like the news was about the squad versus Pelosi, and Donald Trump wanted to jump in on that.
And sorry, what I meant by immigration is that the conflict seemed to have stemmed from those four lawmakers not voting with the rest of the Democrats on funding with regard to detention of migrants at the border.
Yeah, and I actually think that this is, I would say this is a strategic blunder on Pelosi's part. So these four congresswomen, I just like the label, the squad, by the way, and we can talk about it later. I know that AOC has captioned like an Instagram photograph with her and those other members as squad, but it is interesting to me to watch everyone sort of perpetuate that. I associate it with a Taylor Swift girl gang thing and think it's a bit, whether or not those four congressmen would like it and own it, that's up to them, but I do think it has certain internet connotations that aren't quite as serious as what I think their mission is, which is if you talk to people who are their advisors or who work with them, their idea and their mold or their historical precedent, they like to think of themselves as the radical Republicans, right? The Republicans back in the Civil War who were rabidly abolitionist and said to Lincoln and to the Republican Party, this is the moral stance we're taking and we don't care about your compromise, right? So these people in the more progressive caucus, in Pelosi's wider Democratic caucus, are always going to vote this way, right? They're always going to be no compromise on Trump's immigration stuff. This is, you know, BS. Nancy Pelosi, we don't want any part of this. That's fine, right? That's like their thing within the caucus. I think Pelosi has been baited into a fight she shouldn't have taken, which is she was the one who in an interview sort of said, well, they don't have any power, right? With Maureen Dowd. And Nancy Pelosi said this. They only have four votes and that's all they've got. Well, Nancy Pelosi probably shouldn't have said that to Maureen Dowd, because whether or not that's true within Congress, those four women have an awful lot of media sway. And also, that's their entire purpose, and everyone knows it within the Democratic caucus, is they're purposefully instigating and radical. So the fact that Pelosi kind of took the fight outside the family was, to me, quite a unforced error. And it perpetuated this news cycle for a week, as Perry said, that was all about internecine squabbles. Obviously, Kellyanne Conway got in there and made it a cat fight, so she put it into a gendered thing. And now Trump is on top of it. This is the point of this small caucus of progressives, that they're always going to be hardliners, and that Pelosi should probably at some point stop taking the bait that outside people give her.
So back to Trump, though, obviously what he said in all of this has eclipsed, I think, that dynamic at this point, at least, in terms of
it's
being
a talent
pretty
of his, yes.
Bluntly racist.
Yeah.
How have Americans, lawmakers, people in general reacted to what Trump said on Sunday?
Well, Republicans were pretty quiet. There wasn't even the, I guess it's not thoughts and prayers, right? But there wasn't even like the usual like distancing rhetoric, like this is inappropriate. I hope the president will find better ways to communicate, blah, blah, blah. There was very little, if any, of that, with the exception of Justin Amash.
Who is no longer a Republican.
Who is no longer a Republican. And Lindsey Graham went on one of the shows, I forget if it was this morning or last morning, right, and was like, yeah, these people are communists, basically, and screw them. Good old Lindsey.
Good impression. So,
it wasn't meant to be an impression. But yeah, we don't know yet how the public will react to it in the polls. I mean, this happened over the weekend. There were a couple of approval rating numbers that kind of ticked in this morning, but they're only based on one day of interviews. They actually did look like they were a little bit down for Trump, but like it's way too early to infer anything from that. And I don't think, by the way, that people should be expecting there to be like a massive drop off in his approval rating. It tends not to move the numbers that much. I mean, Charlottesville didn't really move the numbers that much, which is different than saying it doesn't matter. Remember, a lot of Americans, including some who support President Trump, think that he is racist, or at least partially racist, right? So it's not breaking news here. This has been a strategy from way back in 2015. So America has been living with it, for better or worse, for 4 years now. At the margin, does it affect things? I don't know, right? On the other hand, what are all the reasons that like he has a 42% approval rating overall, despite this record-breaking jobs numbers? And I think that's part of it. And I think maybe the president is wrong to assume, if this is what he does assume, that rekindling these types of issues will help him in 2020.
And just to fully quote Lindsey Graham here, he said on Fox and Friends this morning, we all know that, and this is inserted, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and this crowd are a bunch of communists. They hate Israel. They hate our own country. And he went on to say, they're calling the guards along the Border Patrol agents, concentration camp guards. They accuse people who support Israel of doing it for the Benjamins. They're anti-Semitic. They're anti-America. So somebody who used to be a critic of Trump, pretty much in lockstep with the president's comments.
Yeah. And, it, you know, it's this group of four congresswomen are also easy targets because I think a lot of Democrats are uncomfortable with their policies. And I think probably a lot of Democrats are also, you know, subconsciously or not subconsciously, they look different. They're young. They speak in a different way, i.e. like the language of social media. They don't let things slide by, right? They always clap back. That's the thing that is distinguishing about this group of people. They are engaging with the fight. So I think a lot of Democrats aren't used to politicians being that way. So it's a ripe target, and Trump probably knows that because he sees a lot of people being like, this is a very new thing in politics.
This is example number 397 or 3014 of how Trump has taken over the Republican Party. You know, we're 2 years away from Charlottesville. I remember that day, a lot of Republicans on Twitter in interviews did criticize Trump's remarks. They didn't quite say they were racist, but they said they did not like them, disagree with them. And the silence from basically any Republican in elected office yesterday is telling. I think two things from that. One, some of the anti-Trump Republicans or Trump skeptical Republicans are gone from Congress, like the Jeff Flakes and the Bob Corkers. Others like Amash have left the Republican Party. So one, and then two, the people who are there, my guess is they sort of calculate that getting into a fight with the president isn't worth it. There's nobody that's going to support them on the R side. They'll get plaudits on CNN. They don't matter to them. And so my guess is the Mitt Romneys, and I'm sure Romney will criticize his comments next few days, but overall, most Republicans don't see at this point any incentive to criticize even pretty clearly racist language from the president.
Where's Romney? That's my question on this. Where's Mitt Romney on this stuff?
I assume when he's interviewed next, he'll distance himself from the comments, but he hasn't went out of his way to do so yet.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a very interesting thing. And I think, here's a thought exercise. If Trump had said this about another person of color who is a Democrat in Congress, would Republicans have stood up? Or is it these particular four women in Congress for whom it is political dynamite if a Republican were to defend them because they have become the embodiment of creeping socialism in America?
To kind of go back to what Perry said, it's not just that like a lot of the Trump critics were tired. It's also that Republicans lost most of the swing seats last year. The suburban members of Congress who might be worried about how this might play in their affluent, historically Republican, but increasingly diverse district, they lost to Democrats mostly already. And there are some exceptions, you know, but maybe the exceptions are like, I don't want to be the one who stands out because then I'll be the subject of like a primary challenge. And look, there are a ton of Republicans who retired from Congress before the midterms. That's one thing that helped Democrats to win 40 seats. Maybe it comes out that there is an unexpected retirement in one of the remaining swing districts in a couple of months. And people are just kind of on background. They're saying, I've just had enough with Trump and his rhetoric. And you can't say anything about it because it gets you in trouble. But I'm not comfortable not saying anything. And so I just decided that I'm not going to run for Congress again. Right. So there are consequences there, and the number of retirements are a pretty big deterrent to Republicans' ability to retake the House next year, potentially. The fact that Republicans aren't speaking out about it does not mean that it's free of electoral consequences.
Perry and Claire, at the start, Nate suggested that it's potentially a strategy and was referring to some reporting that Maggie Haberman did about wanting to recreate racial tensions that were alive during the 2016 election. From either reporting that you've done or just basically understanding the dynamic that was around in 2016, does this seem like a strategy on the president's part? Should we expect more of this? Or is it just, this is how he feels and it's not really a strategy, this is what he thinks?
I certainly think it's how he feels. Trump's big competitive advantage in 2016 was saying the things that everyone thought supposedly and no one said, right? So I guess if you're going to assign a strategy to Trump's series of tweets, it would be he thinks a lot of people are thinking this, and so he's going to say it. But I think he's also just a cable news viewer, and this is what was on cable news last week. I do think that this was a bit of a Washington story in a lot of ways, and it broke. Well, I don't know if it's broken out. It did happen over a weekend. You know, maybe people are going to tune in today and see stuff. But I think that Trump saw an opportunity to slam Democrats. And he did it in a racist series of tweets. And that's just like kind of what he does.
I should say, kind of coming across the transom, So Will Hurd, who is a Republican member from Texas who narrowly won re-election in a border district that I think occupies San Antonio and some of the places around it, did call Trump's tweets racist and xenophobic. So he was one of the few actually survivors, and so maybe you will hear a few people. I mean, things slow down in the summer, so sometimes reactions are slower. But so there is at least one Republican now, member of Congress on the record.
Perry, what do you make of what Trump is doing here or what he's aiming to do?
So if you look at everything he's done since the midterms, the traditional pattern is your party, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama particularly, your party loses the midterms, you kind of go to the center, quote unquote. You sort of try to meet in the middle, work with the other party a little bit. Trump is definitely not doing that. The piece Nate wrote about Trump's base is not big enough to win re-election or it's not the majority of Americans, Trump does not agree with that, or he's trying to build up that base further, or he's trying to everything he's done this year, including this tweet and his immigration policies overall, it's clear that his immigration views are support for immigration is going up in the public and is at its highest levels ever. And that's because of a backlash to how Trump speaks about immigration and race. He does not care about that. And this is like the latest evidence that his strategy is not changing. He's going to try to win re-election by basically sort of increasing the number of people who feel this way about immigrants, minorities, et cetera.
Wait, but you're saying that it's actively not working. He has seen people go the opposite direction in terms of opinion about immigrants or race.
Well, I don't know if we don't know it's not working, because his campaign staff seems to be hinting that their strategy is to increase turnout among people who feel this way. So there is a base strategy. So I can't say it's not working if Election Day they win Florida by 5 points because every white working class person voted for them, and some people who didn't vote in 2016 vote in 2020, it may have worked. I don't know if it didn't. It's not working according to our metrics right now, but I'm not going to say it isn't working in 2020 because I don't know.
Yeah, and we do, you know, by the way, there was another congressman from Texas, Pete Olson, who also denounced the comments now. But, you know, we do have to keep in mind that the math is pretty different between the Electoral College and the race for the House, for example, where you don't actually have that many diverse high-income suburbs that matter that much in the Electoral College. It tends to be more working-class voters. So I know it's a point we make a lot on this show. I just think it's important to say, like, there is some... I don't know that the present strategy is good. I mean, I think it's probably not if it is a strategy. But the entire reason that Trump won the White House is because of the Electoral College. And so understanding where the coalitions are located in different states, and that kind of gives more power to the fact that you have white working class voters. I mean, that's something which we say a lot, but it kind of can't be said enough.
And that's if you're saying Democrats are trying to win back Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, not say if they were like, okay, well, we're just going to make a bid for Texas, Georgia, and Arizona.
Well, and we've talked about this too, right? Maybe in 4 or 8 years, then the path of least resistance to Democrats is trying to win those southern states. I'm not sure it is now. I'm a little skeptical about that. You know, clearly the president, I think, is banking on a strategy, frankly, where he holds the upper Midwest and wins election on that basis.
I mean, I did want to make one point that Claire was hinting at, too, which is that we've talked about the sort of Trump side of this whole debate with AOC and that group. But the Democratic side is interesting because 80 House Democrats are for impeachment, about 90 are for the Green New Deal, and about 115 are for Medicare for All. So these are the kind of issues where the quote-unquote squad is on one side and Pelosi's on the other. So it's actually a sort of a complicated debate where, like, a Medicare for All, about the caucus is about half and half split, for example. So we focus on these four people, Presley and AOC and so on, versus Pelosi, but really the silent majority in the House is the real story here. And right now where you see is they're split between the two wings, not quite evenly. Most of them are still with Pelosi on questions like impeachment, but it's not just 4 versus 231. It's a closer balance than that.
Are you just saying that this is more of a media creation, or what is the dynamic here that is focusing on those four? I mean, I know specifically on
the border
funding.
Right, the border funding.
Those were the four people who voted apart from the rest of the caucus.
They're the outspoken people.
But they're speaking for something that's not just the four of them. In other words, there is a real fissure here that's not just a media creation. It's not four young people versus Nancy Pelosi. It's actually there are deep questions about how left to go within that party. And I think the we're focusing on the four people who are sort of leading the push, but it's not just those four people. In other words, I think it's just every story on some level about Biden and Pelosi versus Warren or AOC all have these same kinds of dynamics. Like we're in a sort of a year or 2 year long fight for the future of the Democratic Party. And that's what you saw over the last week.
Do you guys agree with that?
Well, I mean, you know, they are bucking. So if you actually look at our Trump scoreboard, right, how often do different members of Congress wind up taking President Trump's position, then AOC actually has one of the highest Trump minus scores in Congress, meaning that for a district where you expect to have a down the line, I'm not sure how to use the term liberal anymore because she's kind of more liberal, right? But like expect to have like a loyal, quote unquote, guaranteed to back Nancy Pelosi literally 100% of the time, right? Instead, she bucks Pelosi about 15% of the time so far. And so for Pelosi, it's a real reason to be concerned. You know, I do tend to agree with Claire, though, that like obviously you have four votes. And by the way, most of what the House does doesn't really matter because the Senate won't do the same thing anyway. And that she has a big enough margin where you can lose four votes doesn't really matter. Right. And so there's very little practical consequence to this. And if you are giving them a bigger platform, then maybe it's kind of strategically dubious. And by the way, AOC is pretty smart about how to clap back, to use that term, right? And she's, it's a generational thing or I don't know what, right? But like
the young people are just better at clapping back.
I don't know, you know, except for the late John Dingell. I don't know if there were any congressmen who used over the age of 60 or women who used Twitter very well.
But you're that's kind of, ageism.
It's, I don't care. But you're picking a fight on someone else's terms, and that seems like a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are going to leave that conversation there and move on to a Democratic challenge to Mitch McConnell in 2020. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. It's the middle of the night. You're tossing and turning, not sleeping, covered in sweat. Sure, running the AC or a fan all night can help a bit, but to sleep really cool and comfortable, get rid of your heat-trapping mattress and get a Casper. The Casper mattress combines four layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool all night, all summer long. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. Casper also has free shipping and returns, so you'll be able to try your Casper mattress for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. Sleep cool and comfortable every night. Get a Casper mattress. Try yours for 100 nights with free shipping and returns. Go to casper.com/politics and use code politics for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics, code politics, and get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Bespoke Post. With their box of awesome, Bespoke Post sends guys only the best stuff every month. They test everything in the box of awesome themselves, from style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, and outdoor gear. Every product gets put through the ringer before it gets put inside a monthly box of awesome. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick out the right box of awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel anytime. Each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. Get $20 off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter code politics at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code politics, for 20% off your first box. We're back, and former Marine fighter pilot Amy McGrath announced her campaign for Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's Senate seat last week. Listeners may remember McGrath from her race in Kentucky's 6th Congressional District last year, which she lost by 3 points. In any case, her announcement sparked plenty of commentary about how vulnerable or not McConnell really is. So let's weigh in on that debate. And I'd just like to gauge the three of you to start off with, how would you rate McConnell's vulnerability, Perry?
Extremely low. He's a Republican in a state that's fairly pro-Trump. He's running in 2020, so Trump will be on the ballot. So, you know, Trump will probably win in Kentucky by at least 12 and maybe 15 and probably more than 15. So in that sense, like McGrath is going to have to win a race where the top of the ticket is really far against her. So it'll be very hard, even if McConnell is personally unpopular.
And it's worth saying that Perry is joining us from Kentucky. So good to have somebody on the ground in the state that we're talking about. Nate, go ahead.
I mean, there are conditions under which she could win, And the conditions probably involve, number one, Democrats having a really strong national environment like they did in 2018. And number two, that she kind of actually proves to be indeed a highly effective candidate, which is a little bit subjective, right? And remember, she lost her race. She was actually one of the relatively few Democrats in swing districts to lose in 2018, which is important to keep in mind because sometimes people are like, oh, military credentials are great. Not always clear that they actually play all that well at the ballot box. I do think, however, people are like a little too fond of using terms like impossible or whatever, right? You know, I think she has probably somewhere in the neighborhood of a 10 or 20% chance, right?
Do you remember those t-shirts that they used to sell at Urban Outfitters in like the early aughts that said getting lucky in Kentucky?
Getting lucky.
That's probably like the campaign slogan. But I mean, there's something to be said for Democrats. She raised like a shitload of money in her congressional campaign. It's going to be an expensive race. There is something to be said from like a strategic point, looking at the Senate map, with which the Democrats are likely to lose. Just like putting out candidates and forcing Republicans to spend money in lots of places. Like, there is some logic to this. And you know, the idea that, well, if you don't have a viable candidate in every election, then you're just going to cede states. And I think Democrats probably also have some long-term, or I don't know if they do, they should have some long-term plan to say, like, your voters will start to atrophy or tune out if you don't have viable candidates in elections that they can vote for, and you can, in, you know, your state, you should be thinking about the politics of your state.
So it's more than just this race.
I mean, there's a little bit of two, people are like, you know, I kind of tweet out that, oh, I think she has a chance, and if you want to be clear, it's not that high a chance, but it's, you know, meaningfully above zero, and probably meaningfully below 25.
But meaningfully, like, above zero, meaningfully below 25, the Nate Silver score.
People are like, well, you're going to waste resources. I mean, first of all, it's not our job at 538 to tell the parties or voters how to spend resources, right? You know, second of all, to the extent that you have money going into the race on the Democratic side, that would also mean money goes into the race on the Republican side probably as well. You know, and third of all, like, fielding viable candidates is a way to take advantage of things that come up. What if there's some scandal involving
Mitch McConnell?
McConnell, for example, right? You know, if you hadn't had a viable candidate like Doug Jones running in Alabama, obviously it's an outlier case to have someone who's, like, literally accused of being a child molester. But McConnell, I think, is different because he is seen as kind of the Republican establishment, and I'm sure Trump wanting to protect that Senate seat will say nice things about McConnell. But you can imagine it being harder with him than with like a generic Republican. You can imagine McConnell having unique issues. And McConnell is, by the way, deeply unpopular. He has, according to Morning Consult, the worst net approval rating in the country. It's about negative 12 or something like that of any senator. So,
he's literally the least popular senator in the country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How does he compare to people like Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer?
In their districts, Schumer's fairly popular in New York State. McConnell is unpopular with voters in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah, so that's not nationally. That's just in Kentucky. He's at negative
significantly 13. Underwater with voters in Kentucky. To look at that, because ordinarily someone's approval rating is a okay proxy for will they be reelected or not, right? So to look at a negative 12 approval rating and say, oh, McGrath has no chance, like, that doesn't really compute for me. I think that shows overconfidence in terms of, like, you have an outlier where he's very unpopular, but it's a very red state, and it's going to be, I'm sure, a fairly strong Trump turnout in Kentucky. But you have two unmatching things, and yeah, you're probably right to count on partisanship prevailing, but there's a difference between being, like, 85% confident in that and being certain that, like, oh, she can't win.
So let me disagree with what Nate said, just to have a discussion. I don't know if it's our job to tell parties what to do. I agree with that. But Amy McGrath, because she's running against Mitch McConnell, will probably raise $20 million from small donors around the country. So she raised $2.5 million on the first day, I think $3.5 million in the first week. So she's going to have $20 million because people hate Mitch McConnell all over the country. If I were running the DSCC, would I spend a lot more dollars than that $20 million? I think the answer to that might be no, because any dollar coming to what I would argue is a race that's going to be very, very hard to win would be taken away from like a North Carolina or an Iowa or a Colorado or a Maine, races that I think are much more, I guess the question might be, like, how much do you take in the core partisanship of a state and ignore the candidates themselves? And I might lean pretty heavily at this point in the world's history toward candidates in a presidential year like this. I think in 2016, the Senate and the presidency were sort of perfectly aligned in terms of the race. So I do think the people who are saying it is basically almost lost are not crazy.
Yeah.
We know. I mean, I think parties screw up by being too narrow. I mean, Hillary Clinton's basic problem in 2016 is that she did not have enough uncertainty in her models, and therefore she thought that she knew the five states election would come down to, when in fact there were 10 or 12 states that were actually in play. And so I just think fundamentally, like, playing a broader playing field is fundamentally a good strategy, even in an era where, yes, things are very partisan, there's less and less cross-party voting. And by the way, if McGrath is trailing McConnell by 9 points by middle of next year,
then
Democrats, if they're trying to maximize their party's chances of winning the Senate, probably shouldn't donate there. But I think it might be a race where actually the polls kind of show it close initially, and then McConnell gradually develops a lead, which is kind of the pattern sometimes in these races. But still, Democrats are capable of being strategic and reading the numbers.
Just while we're on the topic of Kentucky, Perry, even if this is a long shot, what does the electorate look like in Kentucky, and what kind of coalition would a Democrat have to put together to win in a place like that?
So I think Kentucky's about 87% white and 13% non-white. So just America is 60% white and 40% non-white. So that's a helpful statistic right there. About a million people live in the Louisville, Kentucky area, which is more liberal. About 4 million live in the state. So essentially a Democrat to win a statewide race here has to win some percentage of people who are not urban, don't live in an urban area, and are not people with college degrees and are not minorities. So you got to win a fairly high number of white people who don't have college degrees, which is a problem for Democrats in every state. It's just, so the difference between like Kentucky and Georgia, for example, is that Georgia just has a lot more minorities and a lot more white people who live in that Atlanta area and therefore likely to be Democrats. Not just that Atlanta is bigger than Louisville, but the percentage of people who live in the Atlanta area is much larger than people who live in the Kentucky, the Louisville area as a percentage of the population. So that's the challenge, is the people who have won in the past in Kentucky, like the past Democratic governor was named Steve Beshear, and he's kind of a Joe Manchin style figure. So that's kind of has been the model for Kentucky Democrats, sort of a Democrat from part of the rural part of the state who maybe has a bit of a drawl, who sort of connects with voters in a certain way. So McGrath would be a different kind of candidate. We haven't had a lot of women win statewide in Kentucky, for example. I'm pretty sure we've never had a female senator before. That covers a lot of states. But McGrath is young. She's a woman. She's fairly left, I would say. And so this is and she's trying to reposition herself. And the military background probably helps, but it's still just a state where it'll be where we haven't seen someone like McGrath win yet, which doesn't mean they can't win, but sort of points to the dynamics here.
Some good numbers to have in mind there. Claire, you mentioned early on that it would take a lot of luck. When you look at the Senate map for next year, what states are you focused on in terms of if Democrats were going to, you know, take the Senate, they should be focused on?
Well, I'm not that focused on the Senate because the presidential election is happening. But I think Arizona is interesting. Mark Kelly, who is the husband of Gabrielle Giffords, is running against Martha McSally. McSally was obviously appointed. McSally is a vulnerable.
She lost that race.
Right, yeah.
Was appointed.
Yeah, so she lost to Democrat Kyrsten Sinema during the actual election and then was appointed to John McCain's Senate seat. She's actually sort of been an interesting senator, and she sort of came out and said, I was sexually assaulted when I was in the military, but she's also tried to embrace Trump a little bit, although I don't think it's necessarily a natural fit for her. I think she was much more of a sort of pre-Trumpian establishment type who, before Trump took over the party, probably would have been one of those people maybe tisking him. That'll be an interesting race to watch.
I do think there's a danger of Democrats focusing on the lowest hanging fruit, meaning Arizona and Colorado and Maine and Alabama, where they're defending Doug Jones's seat.
Oh, yeah. Dougie.
Yeah. Dougie J. Instead of this broader universe of races, including Kansas, for example, right, where Kris Kobach could be the nominee, for example.
And they just won a race against him for governor.
Right.
So that's
particularly
part of that.
He's someone who I think is particularly unpopular. Yes.
And Kansas has been a little weird in terms of having actually oddly become like a little bit more purple in recent years, I think because of Governor Brownback having been unpopular. Alaska is a weird state where sometimes weird things happen. You have a not particularly popular GOP incumbent there. South Carolina, I guess Lindsey Graham's going to win his primary, but what if he doesn't? South Carolina is not as red as you would think, you know? So I don't know. I think in general, like, playing a broad map is smart, and usually every cycle, you know, who would have thought that in this very, very bad cycle for Republicans, for example, that, like, Rick Scott would have won that race in Florida last year? You know, that went against type a little bit, and, you know, sure, 8 times out of 10, things go to type, or 9 times out of 10, but you sure want to have, like, a few opportunities in case things get kind of crazy.
Perry, final word?
I think North Carolina, Iowa are two states to watch, Republican incumbents, but states that in a year, maybe if Joe Biden wins the election by a lot, maybe he drags in. Those are states that I think are interesting because of the presidential stuff, because they're not super, super red. Or North Carolina is already obviously very close, and Iowa has been recently somewhat close, even if it was not very close in 2016.
All right, so the official Nate Silver score is somewhere above 0%, somewhere below 25% for Amy McGrath beating Mitch McConnell in 2020. And the general message is both parties advantage themselves by playing a broad field. Let's move on to the Democratic primary. We've made it this far into the conversation without really talking about the Democratic presidential primary. And we're going to talk about some comparisons we've been seeing between supporters of Senator Sanders and Senator Warren. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. Are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream with rates as low as 5.9% APR with autopay. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees. The rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, you can even get your money in your bank account as soon as the day you apply. The online application is so easy, you can apply right from your phone. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We've talked at various points about lanes within the Democratic primary, which is the extent to which particular types of candidates are competing with similar messages for similar types of voters. From the beginning, it seemed like Sanders and Warren might share supporters given their ideological similarities, but some research from our colleague Nathaniel Rakich and recent polling on voters' second choice candidates has challenged that idea. So, Claire, to start us off, what can we tell about the existence of lanes in the primary at this point from second choice polling?
You know, among people who ranked Bernie Sanders first and Joe Biden first, they sort of vice versa those candidates. So, you know, even though Sanders and Biden don't have a whole lot in common policy-wise, they're in a lane together, right? According to this sort of early...
So Biden's supporters' second choice is Sanders, and Sanders' supporters' second choice is Biden.
Right. And then Warren and Harris are sort of the same thing. So they're in a lane together. And I think that's so interesting because Sanders and Warren are the people that we know to have the most in common ideologically and policy-wise, but are obviously very rhetorically, well, not very, they're rhetorically dissimilar in the sense that, like, Bernie Sanders built a polemical brand in 2016, super anti-establishment, democratic socialist, and Warren has embraced the I'm a capitalist but kind of rhetoric. So I just think it's very interesting because my sense of things, obviously very early on, is that Biden and Sanders are in a lane and Harris and Warren are in a lane for lots of interesting, complicated reasons. I think that there's probably some class stuff going on here where Biden and Sanders are probably seen as like the working man candidate and Warren and Harris are a little more the like thinking person's candidate. And I think tied up in those perceptions are things about gender, which are very sticky. But to me, it was just such a surprising, interesting little nugget and kind of proves that people say they care a lot about policy, but do they?
Well, I know, because look, you have what appears to be, at least on the surface, a fair amount of movement from Sanders to Warren that took place in the past, kind of before this debate, because he was at 24% and now he's at 14 or whatever. When Bernie was at 24% support, which is kind of where he peaked a month or so after he declared. I think you can kind of break that 24% down into three roughly equal size piles. I think about 8% of it is just people who are purely going off of name recognition because he was one of the kind of placeholder standard names along with Biden. I think another 8% of it is people who are like hardcore Bernie fans because they buy the message about a revolution, because they think Warren is too much of an establishment sellout, because they, for whatever reason, prefer male candidates to female candidates. It might be a small fraction of that 8% or whatever, but probably somewhere in there. And the last 8% is people who are more kind of conventional left-wing Democrats who are not particularly clamoring for a revolution, but kind of really see it as, I have two appealing options in Warren and Bernie. But the problem is, like, he's lost a lot of the support. He lost, I think, some of the name recognition vote to various people. He lost, I think, some of the more simpatico with the establishment kind of left-wing Democrats. A lot of them he lost to Warren. And so kind of what's left over with the Bernie vote are people who are A, pretty calcified, or B, are still like a long way from making a decision. By the way, when pollsters ask, so Morning Consult, for example, has been a poll that has had some of the better numbers for Bernie. They have him holding up in kind of the high teens, like around 18%, 19% typically. When they put a likely voter screen on those numbers saying, okay, here are people we actually are going to turn out, then Bernie drops quite a bit.
But we're focusing here on the second choices of the people who support those people today. So for Bernie, regardless,
I'm telling you, though, the problem with that is that, like, Bernie already lost a lot of the people who would have had Warren as their second choice.
Nate rejects the premise of your question.
Yeah. All right, fair enough. Okay, Perry, get in here. What do you make of...
I basically agree with Nate, and I was going to say that a lot of the surveys, when they break out people who are very liberal, Warren and Sanders have a lot of supporters who are very liberal ideologically, whatever their demographics are, and then a smaller block of supporters who are call themselves moderate or conservative. So I do think there's some evidence that there's a lot of sort of voting that is not ideology or issues based, but is kind of identity, values, so on based. So, you know, like the fact that Biden and Harris seem to be going for some of the same support tells me we're probably talking about black voters who maybe are not easy to place on the liberal moderate and maybe are not voting on kind of that calculus alone. And I think Nate hinted at the Biden-Sanders voters might be some men, particularly, and people who maybe want a sort of a more demographically conservative candidate, however you frame that. So I think the demographic differences are useful, but I don't want to sort of dismiss the ideology as a factor. And, like, I guess Crooked Media had a poll about second choices too, and they found that Bernie's second choice people are Biden and Warren, but definitely not Harris, which sort of aligns with what I would have guessed. And so I don't think we should totally ignore our intuitions about what the sort of lanes are.
When we look at these camps that are forming, I know, Nate and Perry, you both challenged the conception that Warren and Harris are in one camp and that Biden and Sanders are in another. But it seems like there is some evidence in support of that. And if we look back at the 2016 primary, do we see any similarities in terms of Clinton or Sanders voters siding with either one of those camps or the other?
Yeah, my sense is this, is that Clinton primary voters were probably more those establishment types, maybe more college educated, white collar people. And perhaps they have some sense of regret that they didn't take Sanders and his policies seriously, because we can look at this year's Democratic primary and see that Sanders has exerted huge influence when it comes to what kind of platforms people are putting out. I think Warren, for those, you know, Clinton 2016 primary voters, represents sort of an acceptable packaging of those progressive ideas because she is part of the establishment. And Harris, I think, has a pretty left-leaning progressive platform in part because of the 2016 primary. But 2016 Bernie voters are probably still in some sense with Bernie because Bernie still has the burn the system down rhetoric. And I think Warren Harris voters, you know, if you think of them as college educated, white collar types, that's obviously a broad generalization. But those are people for whom the system works pretty well. And they don't want to completely overturn it the way that a Sanders voter might. And I think that has to do with class. I think that has to do with money. And I do recognize that, like, there are gender things to get into, but it's not just gender and it's not just class. It's some amalgamation of those. And I think that we as a country, just to talk about the gender point for a quick second, we are more likely to see, whether right or wrong, like Elizabeth Warren has a pretty when you go back, a working class kind of story in the sense of she went to certain kind of colleges, was a working mom, things like that. Her story is a pretty working class story up until the fact that she became a Harvard professor. But Americans...
school by the Charles
River.
No, but
hold on. But Americans are less likely to see liberal women who have succeeded in the classic sense of the American idea. They're less likely to see them as like working class figures. Joe Biden, who has been a senator since he was 30,
wow,
is working class Joe, right? Even though he's a guy who has been in the halls of power from a very young age. And so obviously there is gender stuff going on here, and it's how we conceive of working class, right? Liberal women are generally not seen as working class.
Yeah, I was going to ask here, you were comparing Harris and Warren to Sanders, but then how does Biden fit into all of this? Why is Biden in the Sanders camp for the people who were establishment in 2016 and voted for Clinton?
Because he works the old school, like, idea of union politics. I have ties to those values. Those union people are my people. Like, it's a, even though he's been wearing a suit for a really long time, he is, I think, worked very hard at his reputation of middle class Joe or working class Joe, whatever he did. I mean, he says that. He literally says that lots and lots. And
on
he,
the stump.
On the stump. And it is mildly preposterous when you think of sort of like the level at which he's operating. He's certainly not the most, he's certainly not wealthy in comparison to like a lot of other people running. But he's also not, he's solidly white collar if you just look at the stats.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I kind of go back to the fact that Sanders' support has atrophied a lot from where it was 4 years ago. And I think his campaign has made some mistakes in terms of assuming that, like, the burn the system down or was the reason why he got 40, whatever it was, 3% of the vote against Clinton. You know, I think that's probably a relatively small part of it. And a lot of it is just because people, for various reasons, wanted an alternative to Clinton. Certainly young voters thought that Clinton was out of touch and Bernie was something cool and interesting and spoke a lot more about policies that would affect college students. Which he still does to some degree, right? But I think his campaign has made a mistake by tuning up the burn the system down rhetoric. I mean, it might be too late now, right? Like, now that Warren is doing pretty well, I don't see an obvious path for him to reemerge with 35% of the vote or something that it might take to win when he has, like, 14 or 15% now. And I kind of wonder if we're not making too much of kind of what the remaining 14 or 15% think. And the headline to me is that Sanders, who got 40-some percent of the vote last time, is struggling to keep even kind of a third of the coalition he had last time around. And so where have all that, the 28% that voted for Bernie last time and are not voting for him this time, where did they go? That's actually a bigger group than the 14% that are still with Sanders. I think the fact that Warren has gained and Bernie has fallen is kind of proof that the conventional wisdom about lanes was correct. But I don't know. I don't think Bernie has a lot of great arguments against Warren, because in the first place, he should have been trying to broaden his coalition and being a kinder, gentler Bernie, and I think I say it probably every time Bernie comes up, I think that he has not been running an optimal strategy as far as winning the nomination.
This is my critique of you, Nate, in the way that you look at politicians, is that you're always like, Trump should be like a kinder, gentler version of himself to expand his base. Bernie should be a kinder, gentler version of himself to expand his base. But that's not human nature, right? These are people who are President of the United States, a person who is really sees himself as viable to become president of the United States. These are people with huge egos. They're human. They've decided that's what works. And like, why should you expect them to moderate? I mean, I don't think
if I play poker and someone wants to call in a pot where I'm probably not bluffing because it's human nature to have curiosity about what kind of hand I have, then like, it's human nature. It's understandable, but they still played like. And so, like, I have a right to criticize that or make money from it.
I'm not saying you don't, but I'm just saying, like, your criticism, and criticisms of actually quite a lot of other people who say, rightly, I think your criticism is right, but you don't, I mean, I think we should recognize more that, like, this is not how campaigns work on a lot of levels. They're believers, right? Like, there are a lot of believers on those campaigns, Trump and Sanders, and they believe this thing, and therefore they're probably not going to moderate it. And, like, there might be some voices on those campaigns that say, like, we should do this. But, like, I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of unrealistic... If you're rotting your brain by reading a lot of political commentary, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners are, you probably, like, have these arguments with people where you're like, if only Sanders would moderate or if only Trump would moderate. But it's like, I'm here to tell you, like, they probably won't.
Oh, fair enough. So, like, but, I mean, so, but there's another strain of argument that like kind of assumes that anything campaigns do must be smart and have some deeper strategic reason behind it. You know, I mean, if you want to say that human nature is to do lots of stupid stuff, then I'm on board with that.
Yeah,
and human nature involves like
that's
a lot of ego.
That's my argument.
Okay, then I think we're aligned.
All right, Perry,
make 3 points. So I'll try to make them quickly. I think, first of all, Sanders has actually tried to change since 2016. I think if you look at how he talks about race, for example, and how much outreach he's done to African Americans, he actually, you know, he is a sort of older, set in his ways person, but he actually has tried to adapt and change. And the evidence suggests it's not working. So in some ways, I think he is open. I think he's heard some of the criticisms, tried to adjust, and it's a bigger field. There's a lot of people running. Maybe the lingering resemblance of 2016 is still killing him, but he actually has tried to move to be more of a party person than he used to be. I do think I've written articles, and there's too many articles that frame the Democratic primary as the Warren Sanders wing versus the establishment. And that's true at the elite levels, like Justice Democrats versus Third Way is that division. But I don't think regular voters are, they're consuming some of it this way. And I think Nate is right that Bernie has lost people to Warren. But I do think there are some voters who are kind of ideologically unmoored. And I try to focus myself on covering those people more because they're not necessarily seeing the race the way I am. And the third point I guess I would make is that we're talking about the Bernie Biden people. I don't know this yet because I haven't looked it up precisely, but about 20% of the Democrats, depending on the poll, will take the sort of unwoke position. Meaning if you ask them, is there a lot of racism or just a little bit of racism? They'll say something like a little bit of racism. Like, is there a lot of sexual harassment or is a little bit of sexual harassment? They'll say not as much as we say. So I do think there's about a quarter of Democrats who are not sort of on the wokest of woke ends of things. And Warren and Harris, whatever you think about them, are running as pretty woke people on the issues. They are women, but also they are woke on the racial issues, I would say, in a way that, like, the way Harris and Biden talk about race is fairly different, I say. So I do wonder if you look at that 25% of the sort of unwoke, I'm making up a phrase here, if those people are more with Biden and second choice Sanders or vice versa. My guess is yes.
Yeah, because you did make that point earlier about how if you look at polls of very liberal voters, that Warren has overtaken Bernie with that group. There haven't been that many polls that broke out since the debate. I imagine Harris is doing fine with that group also. So Sanders actually gets some support from Democrats who think of themselves as moderate or conservative, although obviously Biden gets way, way more. But then I do wonder if those sorts of people are going to actually be the ones who turn out to vote or not. I don't know.
Well, as we end every podcast, only time will tell. So let's leave it with that. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks. Should we make merch of that? It's too early.
Only time will tell. It's too early.
Only time will tell. And it's
too
early. Just
turnout will determine.
Yeah, only the only poll that counts is election day.
We could do like Nate's profile or something. You know how people used to do those Bernie things? You don't really have any catchphrases.
Like
though.
A tote bag with a Nate catchphrase on it? No thanks. Perry, okay. Thank
or
you
a fox.
For Perry, thank
Maybe
you for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, guys.
And before we go, I want to mention that we have a live show coming up on August 1st in Detroit. We're gonna be in Detroit for the debates. And so the debates are Tuesday and Wednesday, and then we're going to be hosting a live show that Thursday. You can find out more information and get tickets at 538.com/live.
Get tickets. Come.
Get tickets.
It will be great.
It's my home state.
It's his home state, right?
Yeah.
Do you talk more like a Michigander when you're in your home state? You know.
I actually, okay, come on. I have like, the way I say sorry, apparently, is very Michiganderish. I pick stuff up, though, after like, if I'm like, in the South
when you're
for a
drunk.
Few days.
Nate says some. He says like say Minnesota, Nate.
Minnesota.
Yeah, he says that with like a weird.
Oh, that's very Sarah Palin-ish. Yeah,
that's the right way to say it though. That's how the state's pronounced.
Anyway, we like Michigan. You should buy tickets.
Yes, get tickets 538.com/live. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.